This is the Not Old, Better Show, and I'm Paul Vogelsang. My guest today is Dr. Paul Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg has written an important book, A Salamander's Tale, which is an unexpected, refreshing, often very funny memoir about his long journey with cancer and how he not only solved the case of keeping himself alive, despite recommendations from the medical community to proceed with surgical castration, but of living better. Today's show will be especially important for men and the women who love them here on the Not Old, Better Show.
Well, we know you have metastatic disease, and we think that you need to be castrated to remove testosterone, which fuels the prostate cancer cells. So about 5 years later, to find out that everybody, a whole chorus of people, are recommending castration, permanent surgical castration.
Thousands of men are coping with prostate cancer every year, and some people are losing their lives to it. Can you imagine if you're a 35-year-old doctor and you're told that you have advanced prostate cancer, an aggressive prostate cancer? What would you do? Well, one doctor who got that diagnosis more than 30 years ago fought back, and he fought back in a big way. He is now one of our nation's longest living prostate cancer survivors. And he's written a really wonderful book about his journey. It's called A Salamander's Tale, and it's a play on words. And we're going to find out how. Throughout his fight with prostate cancer, Paul Steinberg was forced to take two simultaneous journeys. The first was to transition from doctor to patient and surrender his physical health to a medical establishment he knew from firsthand knowledge would be using approaches that would be outdated within a few years. The second was a spiritual journey. His search for a higher meaning in life sent him as far as walking over hot coals with Tony Robbins. Using the salamander as his role model, Steinberg, a college health and sports psychiatrist, takes a look at the evolution of the regenerative capabilities of cold-blooded vertebrates like the salamander, and at what we as humans have lost and gained in our warm-bloodedness. Dr. Steinberg also discusses how prostate cancer evolves and how prostate cancer changes with our age.
The rule of thumb, it's a bit simplistic, is that if you're 50 years old, you have a 50% chance of having the disease, even if you're not aware of it. If you're 90 years old, a 90% chance of having it. But if you're 35 years old, you probably have a 35% chance of having it, even if you don't realize it until 5 or 10 years later.
With wit and humor, Steinberg tackles lust and sex and ultimately time and death and the gods. Having lived longer than virtually anyone else with metastatic prostate cancer, he uses his knowledge as a doctor and experience as a patient to provide a story of endurance and perseverance, weaving a tale of grace, regeneration, and redemption. Just not the kind of regeneration and redemption that he or anyone else would expect.
We think you've got metastatic disease, and well, we know you have metastatic disease, and we think that you need to be castrated to remove testosterone, which fuels the prostate cancer cells. And at that time, I said, geez, over my dead body. I have a line in an article that I wrote using Patrick Henry's notion, give me libido or give me death.
You can find out more about Dr. Steinberg, his journey, and his thoughts about life, happiness, and living a full life at PaulSteinbergMD.com. One of the fascinating components of that website is the cancer timeline and each step along Paul's amazing journey. Again, that's PaulSteinbergMD.com. Today, join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Steinberg. Well, Paul, at 35, you were told you had aggressive prostate cancer. And for most of my listeners, that's a very young age. But now, 30 plus years later, you are, I read this, you're one of our nation's longest living prostate cancer survivors. I think that's how it was put. And you've written this really wonderful book about your journey, A Salamander's Tale. And we're going to talk about the book in just a minute, but Dr. Paul Steinberg, my guest today and author of the great book, joins us now. Paul, Welcome to the Not Old, Better show. And if you would, maybe start by telling our audience a little bit about the disease and maybe especially take us back 30 years ago and give us a sense as to what we knew then about the disease versus what we know now about prostate cancer.
Well, fortunately, Paul, we know a heck of a lot more than we did 30 years. So actually closer to 32 years ago now, since it's been a year or two since the book came out, or at least all the efforts to edit it and put it together were done. But 32 years ago, back in 1984, when I was first dealing with it, our understanding was quite primitive. And as you may know from reading the book, I was initially told that I might have just a 40% chance of living 5 years and as low as just a 15% chance of living 10 years. So we've now been able to take a very aggressive disease, a stone cold killer, as I call it in the book, into something that's more chronic illness, something that we can fortunately live with. It's not easy to live with, but man, it's better to live than to die. And so I'm very fortunate to be around and be able to talk about this experience and to hopefully inspire many other men and their partners in dealing with this or dealing with any kind of blows, any kind of losses, any kind of tragedies that any of us face.
I think that's a good way of putting it. I think we all do face these challenges along our journey. It's fortunate for us, too, that you're still around to share this, Dr. Steinberg. I really value your perspective. And I think that when you first kind of learned about this, you fought back and you fought back hard. I think that's a really interesting point in this process. But how common is it for men in their 30s to be diagnosed with prostate cancer?
It's more common than one realizes. I've certainly encountered a number of people over the last 30 years who were diagnosed even in their late 20s, early 30s, even younger than I was at the time. And the rule of thumb, it's a bit simplistic, is that if you're 50 years old, you have a 50% chance of having the disease, even if you're not aware of it. If you're 90 years old, a 90% chance of having it. But if you're 35 years old, you probably have a 35% chance of having it, even if you don't realize it until 5 or 10 years later. I was fortunate to realize it pretty quickly. I was fortunate at the time I went to see my internist for my yearly physical exam, again at the age of 35, and just without our realizing it, just with a rectal exam, the prostate seemed harder than it should have been and malformed in a way that it shouldn't have been. And at that time, we weren't sure what it was. He recommended that I go to see a chairman of a well-known teaching hospital here in Washington, D.C. And the physician at that time, the urologist, told me, one thing we can be certain of is that you're too young to have prostate cancer. So it's got to be something else, so some esoteric disease like a tuberculous prostate. Turned out he was completely wrong. But I took him seriously and said, I just guess I don't have that much to worry about. But I indeed did have plenty to worry about and ended up at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York City, where they told me, you ain't going anywhere. We've done an ultrasound. This is prostate cancer until proven otherwise. And they were quite right in responding in that more urgent way.
That must have been a real shock and really a potentially devastating moment to a man who at 35 had a young family, a thriving marriage, many family goals. You were active in sports, playing competitive tennis. What kinds of treatments were available to you then? And I understand that, you know, in some cases, you can just live with this, but you had a very aggressive form of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. It wasn't clear until we did the surgery, the radical prostatectomy. It wasn't clear until then that the cancer cells had moved beyond the capsule of the prostate, above the shell of the prostate. So they were lurking potentially everywhere. And that was the real concern, that you don't have metastatic disease at this point. The seminal vesicles, for example, are clear. Your lymph nodes are clear. But it's probably just a matter of time before you may have disease that has spread to other parts of the body. Now, the surgery surgeons were great at the time. I had two urological surgeons up at Columbia, and I love surgeons who say, oh, we got it all. Their optimism was contagious. And it was nice to hear that, even though it turned out to be wrong. But at least for the next 4 to 5 years, I could live comfortably and not worry about it until the prostate-specific antigen became available. And people don't realize, again, this is a major breakthrough. The PSA is very, very helpful after you've had the prostate removed. The PSA, this antigen, should be absolute zero because the prostate has been removed, and it wasn't zero. Unbeknownst to me, it was experimented with by my urologist up in New York City. In 1988, it was 0.6, which nobody knew how to interpret. It should have, again, been totally zero. But a year later, it was 2.1, and that's what he called me and said, we've got this PSA. We don't know what to make of it. Nobody can really interpret it. We think you've got metastatic disease, and, well, we know you have metastatic disease, but and we think that you need to be castrated to remove testosterone, which fuels the prostate cancer cells. And at that time, I said, geez, over my dead body. I have a line in an article that I wrote using Patrick Henry's notion, give me libido or give me death. I was very, very fortunate at the time. I was to think about how devastating it is first to get prostate cancer, but 5 years later to find out that everybody, a whole chorus of people, are recommending castration, permanent surgical castration. At that time, I took leave for a week or two from my office at Georgetown University. I was the associate director of the psychiatric service for students there for many years, then became the director ultimately. But at that time, I took a week or two off, sat down with my wife, Helen, and several of my friends. And one of my friends said, listen, you've always been really good at finding the best people to talk to about this. Get some real expertise. This is not a time to stop that practice now. So I happened to find a way to call a fellow named Gerald Murphy, who had developed the PSA a number of years ago. It was still being used experimentally. But he was now at the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. I somehow was able to reach him in the middle of the lunch hour, and I told him my story in a kind of frantic way. They're recommending castration immediately. He started chuckling, and I started thinking, this guy is really a bozo, but it turned out he was chuckling because he pointed out we now know that the PSA can rise to 10, 20, 30 without any signs of palpable, visible disease. Go back to work, go back and help people as a psychiatrist, as a physician, and don't worry about yourself right now, and give it some time. We'll find some other answers over time. And that was the best piece of advice. It was a life-saving piece of advice for me, and I was very fortunate to have been able to reach him at the time.
That was fortuitous, and I marveled at some of the creative steps that you took. I also really enjoyed in the book your sense of humor. This is a very serious subject, but you have a nice way of putting this in a very humorous manner with quotes from Robin Williams and others in the book that can really almost diminish some of these terms, like, you know, frankly, it's almost a barbarous way of referring to this chemical castration. You need almost a sense of humor to understand and deal with that.
Absolutely. One of the points that I make and tell my friends about this is that prostate cancer is the ultimate cosmic joke for men. And as one reviewer pointed out, this book is at once raw, funny, profane, and uplifting. And those are great qualities for the book, and I often tell people that it's probably a good description of me as well. No, this is a cosmic joke, and, you know, we think of people, say, foodies or wine tasters who suddenly lose their sense of smell and taste. It's devastating for them. Well, think about the males of our species suddenly losing their sexual function, their libido, their lust for life and for sex, their erectile capabilities, their fertility potentially with potential castration. I mean, this is what makes us human and what allows for survival of the species, and to lose all of these qualities is just absolutely potentially devastating.
Oh, yeah. It was interesting for me to read, too, about the idea of this chemical castration treatment, that it involves really a testosterone component, and that testosterone seems to be very much in vogue in many areas of medicine right now, and there's a lot of controversy around it. The two products that, you know, the testosterone gel, Androgel and Axiron, they seem to be, you know, kind of the medicine du jour at the moment. But you kind of were dealing with this from very much a diagnosis standpoint, that this process, kind of this treatment plan of kind of a testosterone on again, off again kind of program was what you really needed.
Yes. Paul, as you point out, there's all sorts of questions about people having low T, low testosterone, and needing Androgel and these gel forms of testosterone. And there were initially some concerns that it might increase the possibility of prostate cancer. I think that turned out not to be the case. We men generally do very well with testosterone. If we need more because we have a low T, it seems to be okay. For me, once I develop the prostate cancer, then if the PSA is rising, if there's signs that I have this disease spreading to other parts of the body, then I have to go through periods of getting rid of the testosterone, because the testosterone does fuel the prostate cancer. Again, one of those cosmic jokes. But at the time, as I mentioned earlier, there was a chorus of physicians, including experts from the New England Journal of Medicine back in the late 80s, indicating that the sooner someone like myself gets permanent surgical castration and reduces all testosterone from my body, the longer I'll live. And that turned out to be an ideology, a viewpoint that was absolutely false. Again, I was very, very fortunate. I had this opportunity to go up to New York City when my PSA was rising. Some experts were recommending that I have a monoclonal antibody test up there. Monoclonal antibodies turn out to be very effective now in the 21st century, but back in 1989, they were very primitive and not very useful. And at the time, the physicians looked at the monoclonal antibody test and said that I've got prostate cancer throughout my body, particularly in lymph nodes along the carotid artery, and that they had a vascular surgeon waiting in the wings to actually dissect my carotid artery. Fortunately, I called my internist at the time and said that they're wanting to dissect my carotid artery. Should I let them do that? And my internist doesn't usually curse, but he said something to the effect, get the hell out of there before they kill you. And he was absolutely right. But fortunately, while I was up in New York City, I went over to Sloan Kettering to speak to another expert asking, what can I do besides castration? And he recommended a particular medication that's part of chemical castration, Casodex, which is actually used very commonly now, but it was experimental back in 1989, 1990. But he also mentioned, and he said, I've looked at your monoclonal antibody tests. We think you have really aggressive metastatic disease. So I don't recommend this particular thing that I'm going to tell you about, but there's a guy in Vancouver, British Columbia, who is recommending intermittent castration, where you go off a treatment for the metastatic disease for several months and then go back on the treatment. Actually, for 2 years, you go off the treatment and then let the PSA rise and then go back on the treatment. But I don't recommend it because you have too aggressive disease. Well, I called this fellow, Nicholas Bukowski, in Vancouver, British Columbia, right away. He said, you're a perfect candidate for this. But because he was in Vancouver, British Columbia, sort of the Siberia of the Americas, nobody believed him. Turned out it's now become the de rigueur treatment for prostate cancer that's metastatic, that has spread. But at the time, I was just very, very fortunate, very lucky to have met him, go up to Vancouver, talk to him. He said, you're not ready for this treatment just yet. Let the PSA rise to about 8 or 9 or 10. It was at that time 2 or 3. Let it rise. You're sort of playing a joke with the prostate cancer cells. You're getting them excited about the testosterone that you're allowing to, and I'm getting excited myself sexually again, but we're getting the prostate cancer cells really excited, and then we remove the testosterone, and I sort of move myself from being a sexual being for about 6 to 8 months, but it's better than nothing, and then we bring the testosterone back 6 to 8 months later, and so the prostate cancer cells don't look for some other fuel, some other chemical, physiological substance in the body to fuel themselves. They have their own basic survival mechanism. They're going to survive no matter what. But we fool them, we trick them, and allowed me to survive, continue to survive over the last, again, 31, 32 years.
Yeah, and as I say again, we're so grateful that you have survived this. How many times over that 32-year period have you gone through this process, Paul, where you kind of go off treatment, get rid of the testosterone, as I understand it, and then hopefully, I guess, get rid of the cancer cells and then go back on the treatment? Is that kind of the process?
Exactly, exactly. Well, I allow the cancer cells to come back. And a lot of people would find that too ambiguous, too uncertain to allow the cancer cells to come back. And obviously, when the PSA gets up to 8 or 9, I then have to be super vigilant. And at that time, we were using CT scans, full body CT scans, and bone scans to see where the cancer might be. And in 2004, I had my first clear-cut palpable metastasis in the lungs of all places, which is really unusual, and I can tell you more about that experience because nobody believed it could be prostate cancer because it usually goes to bones. But this was old disease and it was going to go wherever it wanted to go. But if you are able to live with that uncertainty and with the desire to trick the cancer cells, you're going to go through a cycle of about two and a half years, a year and a half without treatment, letting the cancer cells come back into their good health and my not so good health, but the fact that I'm back into a good sexual health. It's like Groundhog Day. It's been about 11 times now, and that's over the course of 25 years. Episodically, I'm back to a normal red-blooded male and then back to a position where we remove the testosterone and have to live with this temporary chemical castration. But again, it allows me to live and live with a capital L for those now 25, 27 years of intermittent castration.
The name of the book, again, is The Salamander's Tale by Paul Steinberg, my guest today. And Paul, I found this, I found this in Lancet. The regenerative abilities of salamanders are exceptional. They regrow lost limbs with ease and can even surrender their tails to distract predators, leaving them behind as they flee. Within weeks, the tail will have grown back and the cycle repeats. I have to say that the title of your book is fantastic, given kind of all of those capabilities that salamanders have. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit more in detail, because you no doubt have a much deeper understanding about the salamander's capabilities and what that means to you, you know, now that you've kind of gone through all this.
Well, the salamanders are just incredible creatures. They've been, as you point out, my inspiration. One of the crucial things that people don't realize is they cannot get cancer. You can give them the most carcinogenic chemical in the world, and all they'll do is produce an ectopic, another little limb, a little bump or something like that, but it won't be cancer. They can not only regenerate their tail, they can regenerate every one of their limbs, they can regenerate a really good part of their heart, and they can even regenerate a part of their retina, their entire retina. So this is an amazing species. They're cold-blooded. They're not warm-blooded like we are. So they can actually sit under a log for like 6 to 8 months while a limb or a tail or a heart regenerates. We can't do that. We're warm-blooded. So if you put us under a log for 6 to 8 months and let a limb regenerate, all we produce is scar tissue. Scar tissue sort of produces cancers instead. And if we didn't produce scar tissue, we'd have bacteria growing there, and we would die from the bacterial infection within a matter of days or weeks. So we can't survive in that way. But salamanders have this capacity to produce electrical gradients. So they take stem cells, just like we have stem cells, and those stem cells, through these electrical gradients, can actually move in all the right directions to become vascular cells and nerve cells and muscle fibers, so that they actually recreate the original limb or the heart or the tail. And we can actually regenerate skin and bones. If we fracture a bone, we can regenerate it. If we hurt our skin, we can regenerate it. But we don't have much of a capacity to regenerate other things. But as you know from my book, I talk about the role of acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And acupuncture works in a very similar way. Obviously, we don't have the capacity that salamander has, but acupuncture allows us to create a milder electrical gradient to be able to regenerate parts of our body. And that was important to me after surgery and then radiation to the prostate bed. Originally, I had surgery, radical prostatectomy, in October of 1984. But the surgeons, even though they told me that they got it all, they said, well, let's cover all bases. We think you should get radiation to the prostate bed area and radiate any of the cells, because prostate cancer is radiation sensitive. But if you've had the scalpel to your prostate bed, to your genital area, and then radiation to that area, they also said you have a 0% chance of having sexual function, erectile function. And it turned out that was not the case either, with the help of, turned out, hyperbaric oxygen, which I can talk about as well as acupuncture. I was able to regain significant sexual function. So we human beings can regenerate to some extent, but it's not easy, and one has to be, again, very fortunate, very lucky to find the kinds of interventions that can help.
I thought that was fascinating, the parallel between the acupuncture, the meridians, and then salamanders. I also thought the hyperbaric oxygen component was fascinating, too. And this you really learned through some research about some of what was happening in the Ural Mountains in Russia and the Soviet Union as a result of some of the accidents that took place, some of the radioactive.
The Russians have had plenty of screw-ups with nuclear radiation, as we know. Back in the 1950s, there was a major nuclear disaster in the Ural Mountains where a square mile after square miles of forest and homes were destroyed, and they kept it quiet. And when I first had radiation in January of 1985 after the surgery, the Russians had already, just in previous months, had a major problem at the Russian-Polish border with a nuclear reactor that had major problems that put the disaster in Pennsylvania to a much lower level than what the Russians had to deal with. And so they were desperate. The Russians were desperate to find some antidotes, some solutions for this, for their radiation workers. And long before Chernobyl was about a year and a half later, we were able to realize that the Russians were using hyperbaric oxygen to help with radiation problems. The way radiation works, Paul, is that it creates weird forms of hydrogen and oxygen. We need water in our protoplasms in our lives to be able to survive, H2O. But radiation causes all sorts of weird forms of hydrogen and oxygen, HO2, H2O2, which is hydrogen peroxide, H3O2, all sorts of weird forms of hydrogen and oxygen. And cells can't survive that way. But if you give the body really intense oxygen, you can reawaken some of those cells that are on the verge of death. And that was extremely helpful to me. It also gave me a sense of hope. Even though it didn't work on a permanent basis, I was able to start getting erections back a few months later, within a matter of days after hyperbaric oxygen. We did episodes of 20 each in Mount Vernon, Virginia here, a place where they used hyperbaric oxygen for people coming up from the Caribbean with the bends or carbon monoxide poisoning, things like that. And the hyperbaric oxygen specialist at the time thought, geez, it would be interesting to apply this to radiation effects and radiation damage. And we really got some nice effects initially. It dissipated, but that's where acupuncture came into play as well. So the combination of the two, hyperbaric oxygen and acupuncture, really made quite a difference.
So there was hyperbaric oxygen, acupuncture. You also had some dietary things and even some exercise things that you were really doing to try to maintain and improve, you know, kind of get beyond the pain.
Right. Well, the changes in diet, you know, at that time I just figured, hey, I have nothing to lose. It may be trying to close the barn door after the horses have already escaped, but it also gave me a sense that I at least had some control over the situation I was dealing with, give myself some hope, a sense of control. And there was some information, at least epidemiological data, that indicated that as bad as prostate cancer was in terms of its preponderance here in the United States, it was actually worse in Scandinavia and in Switzerland. Hmm. And my wife and I had actually gone to Switzerland once with our daughters, and we realized that cows were everywhere. If you asked for tomato soup, it was essentially cream soup with a little bit of tomato, and milk and cream and dairy was just everywhere. Hmm. So I sort of realized that there may be something in just the way that we eat, whether it's here in America or in the northern parts of the northern hemisphere and probably the southern hemisphere as well, and that I could change the way that I ate, just going more to a Mediterranean diet, call it oleo and alia, oil and garlic, more of a plant plant-based way of eating with fruits and vegetables, sort of oil and garlic, olive oil, essentially, and eating fish, but just staying away from land animals, whether it's through dairy or whether it's through eating the flesh of these animals. And there is some evidence, Paul, by the way, just recently, that when you look at African Americans, and they have a much higher incidence of prostate cancer than Caucasians do, but if you look at men in Louisiana versus men in North Carolina with prostate cancer, and now genetics may play a role, just a different genetics with Creoles in Louisiana, that there's a much lower incidence of prostate cancer among African Americans in Louisiana than in North Carolina. And the eating is different. In Louisiana, it's all seafood, shellfish. In North Carolina, it's mostly barbecued pork. And that may play a role, a significant role. At the time when I was dealing with this, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine indicating that there was a substance in land animals called oleolinoleic acid that seemed to be associated with prostate cancer. And so at the time I said, oh, this is just more confirmation that I'm staying away from land animals. Turned out not to be necessarily something that was accurate, but that was an idea at the time. But I've been able to manage over the last 32 years now to just avoid anything related to land animals, to just eat Mediterranean-style fruits, vegetables, olive oil, and some fish. And for whatever reason, it's been okay. It's worked out well, but I can't prove that it's necessarily the way to go.
But it's worked. You seem to really be coping well. And I guess my question is, will you do this routine and more the rest of your life?
Well, I think there's some opportunities these days, as many of us are coming to realize that there are some new treatments out there, particularly efforts to enhance the immune system. So one of the things that I'm going to be starting very shortly is using a prostate cancer vaccine that's been around for probably 10 or 15 years. I wasn't really eligible for it until recently, and it's more available now. It's more complicated than your grandmother's old vaccine, the old Sabin-Salk vaccine for polio, but this is a treatment for prostate cancer, a vaccine for prostate cancer. So that's something that I'm considering. And there are some immune system enhancing drugs probably related to monoclonal antibodies. So we have come to see this with Jimmy Carter, for example, who had hepatic melanoma and with a spread to his brain, and it looked like he was a goner in his 90s, but they gave him a drug called Yervoy, ipilimumab, and the cancer cells disappeared, and his brain is functioning as good as normal, good as it was before. So that particular drug, Yervoy, ipilimumab, is even better with prostate cancer. So that's something for many of us with prostate cancer to consider. You know, back in 1989, 1990, Gerald Murphy, who subsequently passed away a couple of years later, who essentially saved my life by telling me that I should not go through permanent surgical castration, said, listen, just try to survive as long as you can. It's sort of like the NCAA tournament, just survive and move on. And if you survive, there may be some other things that come along that are going to be life-saving. And that may be the case with these immune therapy responses, particularly for prostate cancer. And my disease is really at a very, very low level, very minimal level. So some of these treatments may turn out to be very helpful down the road.
Well, we certainly are especially glad that you've survived. There's been so much information shared today, Paul. Thank you. I know you're a sports fan, and I love those sports analogies too, but yeah, we want you to fight on and keep us posted. And I will be putting up a full transcript to this show, because there just has been so much great information. But I just encourage everybody to read the book, The Salamander's Tale by Paul Steinberg, MD. I loved it. The reviews have been very positive. Among the many reviews that I especially liked was from the Washington Post that said, a lively memoir filled with humor and a frank discussion about the sexual and other physical effects of prostate cancer and of its treatment. A man contemplating life, death, biology, psychology, responsibility, the universe. I think, Paul, that says so much about you and so much about the book.
Well, thank you, Paul. As my African-American friends say, I do keep it 100. It really tackles everything in life, and I think it's something that people can really relate to, whatever struggles and challenges they are facing. And the other thing I just want to add is that it is a love story as well, in terms of my wife, Helen, and my two daughters. And, you know, you can't do this alone. You really need the support of a whole village, a whole community. It takes literally a village to survive something like this. So I think it, again, can be very inspiring for a lot of people.
If people want to find you, they can do that at your website, and that's paulsteinbergmd.com. Where else do you like to correspond with people online?
That's probably the best way, and the book is available wherever books are sold, and at Amazon as well, and it's very much available, and people can certainly get in touch with me through the website.
That's great. We'll put links to find the book, too, at Amazon, but Paul Steinberg, thank you so much for sharing this today. This has been just a wonderful program. My best to you and your family. Long life ahead. Please, updates that you do, keep us posted as to how things are going.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you and pleasure to be with your audience.
Thanks, Paul. I'll be talking to you soon.